thing that I thought PDF was obligatory. Just read the instructions in each subject. And in this subject in particular, the requirement is to submit it in Word format, because we normally add comments and set change control, track change, to be able to provide a richer feedback. That's why we prefer to receive it in Word format. At least I do. And I think it's in the instructions. So just so you know, in the future, just read through the information, maybe ask the teachers before they ask. It says so in the PEC description, in the beginning of the sample, to do it in Word format. That's my understanding. Yeah. But every year we get the same thing. Some students forget and submit it in PDF because of the habit in other subjects. So it's difficult to get it right. But if you ever take a language course, for example, or a literature course where we can really add depth to the comments, submit a Word because it's more malleable. It's more modifiable. Okay. So, today we have, really an interesting, fringe author, fringe because, Kate Chopin represents many of the things that we have, that we talked about when we talked about realism, but she also has a certain flavor or a certain reminiscence to a certain supernatural. I wouldn't say supernatural. I would say sometimes bordering a complete lack of, not fully, a lack of faithfulness to just the events of nature. And I would say that for her, nature has like a spiritual or an emotional connection in this in her works. Nature is always dominant or at least present in her works. There is a connection sometimes to fate, to destiny, to liberation. And I want to first of all point out that in the case of Kate Chopin, we have the first author that is openly feminist. This is our grandmother of feminism, and as a proper grandmother of feminism, her work was completely forgotten after her death, and she had to be rescued by scholars much later. And some of her works, for example, there is a short story called "The Storm." It was so avant-garde that it wasn't published until almost 100 years after her death. Kate Chopin represents an oddity, someone completely out of her time, completely ahead of her time, and her views on feminism and on female liberation are quite advanced for her time, and you can really notice some of the things that we're going to see in her biography, how she lived in a sort of matriarchal society not in a matriarchal society, in a matriarchal circle in her inner life. She quickly widowed, even though she held on to the name of her late husband. She widowed and had to use writing as a way of subsisting. So writing for her was a means of life, but at the same time it was a sweet and sour means of life, because her dream was to become a novelist, but her only novel that we'll talk about more than mention, we'll talk about it significantly, The Awakening, that you have probably already read if you've taken, for example, Comentario de Textos Literarios en Lengua Inglesa. I think you took that last year, unless you're picking subjects here and there. And in Géneros, you also study the same subject or the same novel. That's great, because that way you've already had to brush up on Kate Chopin twice. It's part of the purpose. Sometimes you'll see that many subjects reuse the same works. It's an intentional thing to help you reuse the knowledge that you obtain in one subject and from a different perspective. In Comentario de Textos Literarios en Lengua Inglesa, we study Kate Chopin as a very firm and very solid example of feminism, of early feminism before feminism was actually a thing. If you read through The Awakening, I know that that subject is very demanding in terms of the amount of text that you have to read. Yes, poor Edna Pontellier. Exactly. We're going to talk about The Awakening, but as a seminal work, not only for Kate Chopin, which it is, but for feminism itself. It deals with key issues of early feminism, 100 years before feminism was an established literary and cultural movement. So with Kate Chopin, we have this. We have a bit of what we've been seeing with these writers, with Mark Twain, with Henry James, we'll see with Stephen Crane. There seems to be like a shift in the period. We seem to be heading into something newer, fresher, more modern. It's easier and easier to find authors that connect to the contemporary, to our current moment. Kate Chopin is one of those authors. Even though we're going to see that The Awakening, far from being a literary success, was a tremendous failure. Why? For the same reason Moby Dick was. Because it was way ahead of its time, and it was considered to be a flawed novel of an author with very limited talent, and therefore it was deemed a minor work, and it met with a lot of rejection because of the way society was portrayed. And we're going to talk about social portrayal in this unit, in today's class. In the Awakening, Kate Chopin takes a very autobiographical approach and turns the main character into a projection of many of the features that she herself holds as a person. So when Angel was saying poor Edna, at the end of the day, what you're saying is poor Kate. And why would someone say poor Edna, and Edna being the main character of the story? Because she seemed to be completely out of place, completely misunderstood, and not in connection with barely anybody from her own time. That is the feeling that Kate Chopin had during most of her lifetime, that she was, that she felt the world and life in a completely different way than the mainstream way of thinking was. So at the end of the day, what we're going to get in Kate Chopin is a sense of subversive treatment of feminine and female topics. Okay. Of course, women in the late 19th century can still not completely speak their mind, but Kate Chopin manages to get her way mostly through fiction. The Awakening was so unsuccessful that she never again attempted to write a novel again. She stuck to short stories, and it's It's quite fortunate that she did, because her short stories, some of her short stories are some of the most entertaining pieces of fiction that you will ever read in this format. If you're into short stories, they're very easy to read. The prose is very simple. They're like the perfect short stories for all types of audiences. But the choice of topics is always very connected to the choice of topics and to the interests that Chopin had in her lifetime. In the textbook in American Literature to the 1900, the second full paragraph, it begins with something that I think is very important to remember about Kate Chopin. And it's an irony that I use the word remember. She's a forgotten author. So she's been denied her place in history for a very long time, even more than Edgar Allan Poe. Kate Chopin was discovered almost by chance when she had been absolutely forgotten for several generations. The book says, Chopin had been almost forgotten after the publication of The Awakening in 1899 until in 1969, when the Norwegian scholar Per Sehrstad edited her complete works and the first critical biography. In the meantime, the only Chopin text still in print were a few short stories, often anthologized in illustrative examples of regionalist or local color fiction. Regionalist or local color. These are interesting words. Okay, one of the focuses that we're going to be having today is how regional Kate Chopin is. There is a lot of French in her work. French seems to be not only a mechanism of giving her characters more realism, but it seems to be a sort of extra character in her works. The amount of Cajun Creole culture that is embedded in her works makes them a very interesting example of other types of stories, other types of characters of this still young American Republic. We're traveling past the American Civil War through the first 100 years of the Republic. And we're going to enter what is significantly one of the most important periods of industrial revolution and modernization of society in the late 1900s and in the early 20th century. Sorry, in the late 19th century, in the early 20th century, the amount of change that was coming to cities and to countries in terms of technology was just astounding. But far away from that industrialization, there was also a lot of social reform. And within this social reform and how ideas like the American Dream and the self-made man were very latent in the background, counterposed to that or as a backdrop of this American Dream, there has always been a certain amount of dilemmas in these macro concepts that American society had. On the one hand, America seems to be based on morals, on a higher moral standard. But it is also a country that allowed a bigger amount of social liberty. a bigger amount of openness and of changes in society. Of all the avant-garde layers of society, the Creole that we can see examples of Creole culture in what is the Louisiana nowadays, in St. Louis, for example, or New Orleans. We're going to see extremely open people, that are slightly different to the Americans, but they feel very American. So there is a group of people that have French as their second language. They speak it and they use it in a very similar way to how the Chicano community used Spanish afterwards, as a way of maybe tightening the relationships in that part of society. But at the same time, they were fully integrated in American society. So what we're going to see are these conversations of characters that have a very, very strong French upbringing, and they introduce French and words in French and entire expressions in French, and they have a lot of openness towards other things. For example, they seem to be open, but this is going to be one of the topics that we're going to deal with today. They seem to be open to interracial marriage, relationships, and I think that the work that we're going to focus on today is a perfect example. Going back to what Angel was saying, there is a lot of in the awakening, there is a lot of pent up emotion in Edna Pontellier during the entire work, until she receives this wave of liberation and awakening. But I'm not going to spoil that for those of you that haven't read it yet. We're saying that she's going to be a writer that has a very strong regional touch. She brings a lot of local authenticity. She's a fringe writer between branches of realism and naturalism, and sometimes close to some traits of romanticism, but I would say that stronger on those sides of naturalism and realism. Let me read from the glossary that I'm sure that you've used for the PEC. The definition of local color that is in that second paragraph of the unit devoted to Kay Chapin. It says local color, a literary movement that flourished in America in the late 19th century in connection with or as a variety of realism. Local color elements include picturesque landscape, vernacular speech, and the singular manners that characterize a particular region. Famous local color practitioners were Sarah Orne Jewett and Mary Wilkins Freeman, because the labels local colorist and local color realist have often been used derogatorily. Some critics prefer to use the term regionalist. So local color is a sort of deprecation of a type of realism, like, say, this is something that happens in the in certain parts of America where they're too interested in the vernacular and not interested enough in the, let's say, real American society. I was going to see if regionalism had any regarding regionalism. It says a literary movement that focused on realistically depicting the influence of a well-defined geographical region on the characters' lives. American regionalists are often also called local colorists. So as you can see, one term leads to another, and the other leads to the first one. Going back to the textbook, things that we can talk about Kate Chapin, first of all, her the element, the objectives that we have for this unit. We want to learn about these two. This is what we've been focusing on right now. This post-Civil War regionalism or local colorism that it was very, very attractive for people, because remember that people at the end of the day wanted to be entertained. And as a form of entertainment, everything that was out of the norm and out of the normal was highly attractive for other American readers or other readers of English. We're going to see how not until the late 1960s, early 1970s, was Kate Chopin rediscovered by the American readership. And she had remained 65 years of her life in complete, almost complete oblivion. Hers was a story of early success, but after her commercial failure, she was condemned to writing short stories for magazines and periodicals, and she remained in that position of obscurity until she was hailed as a seminal figure of gender studies, very early feminism. Afterwards, there have been other types of criticism about Kate Chopin's work. Maybe we can connect the idea of the treatment of gender in Kate Chopin with the treatment of race. Not particularly in this story, where the racial relationships are more or less treated with, let's say, not so much a negative light, but we can still see some of the flaws of that 19th century society, where races seem to have a specific post depending on their a post in society depending on the color of their skin. We're going to learn more about Chopin's Louisiana short stories. Let me tell you that one of my favorite, maybe my three or four favorite stories, one of them is for sure Kate Chopin's Story of an Hour. And I'm very surprised that Story of an Hour by Kate Chopin is normally not dealt with until the postgraduate courses of in literary studies. I think that in English studies, you don't have to read Story of an Hour. I would really recommend you to do so. It's a very, very short story, and it's a fantastic story. It's so compressed and so easy to read, and the end of the story is so interesting and changing that it's a very, very recommendable tale that I strongly suggest you to find some time to go through it. We're going to focus on the reception of The Awakening and how this narrative of women growth under the perception of her husband's of her husband towards her is a story of female liberation, and it seems almost a handbook of extreme feminism. And I'm just going to leave it there because I really don't want to spoil more than necessary about The Awakening. Regarding the story that we're going to read, Desiree's Baby, it's a simple story that subverts many of the ideas, the images that we have of the old South that were provided in plantation novels. Plantation novels had the habit of sugarcoating life in the South, like lacking any kind of conflict, where if it was about slaves live a contented life where they were very well treated, despite being dispossessed of freedom, and it was like a happy ending story of the slavery narrative. And Desiree's Baby is it's sort of intentionally subversive, but not in a direct way. It subverts the concepts between the lines, and I think that this is what makes the story so interesting. Probably we're going to stop talking about K-Shippen here. I'm going to prefer to play the story, and then we can come back and talk about her and about this work. Okay, so I'm going to do that. I'm going to play the story in the first place. See, I have it here, I think. Desiree's Baby is on page 456. We're going to read Desiree's Baby. I would like you to pay attention to two ideas. The ideas of the symbolism of the story, something very strong in K-Shippen. What things do you think in the story can be deemed as symbols? And the use of adjectives, okay? I would like you to pay special attention to the use of adjectives. On page 455, before the story, Professor Gibert says, when Desiree's Baby was published on January 14th, 1893, in the national fashion magazine Vogue, it was an immediate success. As you can see, we're reading a lot of the stories that were in publications that actually exist nowadays. Harper's Bazaar, The Atlantic, Vogue. That's what these magazines were. At the end of the day, these magazines were not only about the life of the time, but they were also very strong vehicles of culture. They were a way of bringing stories to a society that was lacking sufficient ways of consuming culture, and this was a way of having new and fresh stories to be presented. In this case, Desiree's Baby was originally published in Vogue magazine. This extremely powerful story was included in the collection entitled Bayou Folk. Bayou is a marshland of the area of the Louisiana. And as it was often anthologized, it remained continuously in print while most of K-Shippen's work fell into oblivion. So this Bayou Folk, a collection of stories, was one of the parts of her work that remained easier to find. Her main themes in this story are two: marriage and motherhood. They're explored here through a submissive female protagonist who is far from being like the emancipated heroines that people Chopin's later fiction. This may be the reason why the piece was not considered particularly threatening for quite a long time. When examined in the context of the author's career, however, the depiction of Desiree can be interpreted as an indictment of the patriarchal system so abhorred by the writer. So here you have a writer that 100 years or 75 years before anybody had this concept of a patriarchal society and the problems a patriarchal society had for women's possibilities of being liberated and choosing their own destiny, was putting all of those elements on the table. So this is really a pioneer writer. And that's why I think it's so important to understand and to appreciate the work of K-Shippen. I think that the work that K-Shippen does for feminism is at least at the same height as Virginia Woolf's work for feminism. And that's really putting her up there with all the major figures of feminism. The problem with Kate Chopin is that she was absolutely forgotten for a very significant amount of time, for more than two generations. After 65 years of complete oblivion, her work could be examined in a new light that was very connected to the way people thought in that time. So her way of thinking, her way of denouncing through this subversive, between the lines interpretation, is something that she was doing many decades before anybody thought that that was part of the priorities of the things to change in the world. Additionally, this short narrative deals with miscegenation. Miscegenation is something that we already dealt with James Fenimore Cooper, and it's the lack of acceptance of interracial marriage and interracial breeding of children, how it's considered something unacceptable by a part of society. And her work seems to go in the line of denouncing this concept of miscegenation. Afterwards, we can discuss about why Kate Chopin at the end of the day was also criticized by racial studies authors, and why her role in defending other races is always seen with a degree of suspicion. For now, we only know her name. We haven't talked about her. You have the slide in front of you. We'll go back to that. But I wanted us to deal with the narrative in the first place. This story is told in standard English of the author's audience, but includes glimpses of French, the language that was spoken in the historical context where the plot takes place. Just take into consideration that when she was a child, she was called Catherine O'Flaherty. Her parents were Irish and French, so she had this mixed French upbringing, and she married into the French Creole Cajun society of the time. Without further ado, I'm going to play the story, and then we can continue talking about this.
Desiree's Baby by Kate Chopin. This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Recording by Linda McDaniel. Desiree's Baby by Kate Chopin. As the day was pleasant, Madame Valmondet drove over to La Brie to see Desiree and the baby. It made her laugh to think of Desiree with the baby. Why, it seemed but yesterday that Desiree was little more than a baby herself. When Monsieur, in riding through the gateway of Valmondet, had found her lying asleep in the shadow of the big stone pillar. The little one awoke in his arms and began to cry for Dada. That was as much as she could do or say. Some people thought that she might have strayed there of her own accord, for she was of the toddling age. The prevailing belief was that she had been purposefully left there by a party of Texans, whose canvas-covered wagon, late in the day, had crossed the ferry that Coton Mays kept, just below the plantation. In time, Madame Valmondet abandoned every speculation but the one that Desiree had been sent to her, by a beneficent providence, to be the child of her affection.
Okay, so very quickly, in these terms of symbols that you have to look for. She's an orphan, but she's seen by Madame Valmondet as a providential child. She's sent to the Valmondet family as a providence, okay? So there is this main character that we're starting to know that is called Desiree, and she's just had a baby, and at the same time, that reminds her mother of the day when they found her as a toddler. Okay, so there's this very interesting connection from the first moment where we know immediately that Desiree is not Madame Valmondet's natural child, but an orphan child that they found under a gateway, as she was describing in her memories.
Seeing that she was without child of the flesh, for the girl grew to be beautiful and gentle, affectionate and sincere, the idol of Valmondé. It was no wonder when she stood one day against the stone pillar in whose shadow she had lain asleep 18 years before, that Armand Abagny, riding by and seeing her there, had fallen in love with her. That was the way all the Aubagnys fell in love, as if struck by a pistol shot. The wonder was that he had not loved her before, for he had known her since his father brought him home from Paris, a boy of 8, after his mother died there. The passion that awoke in him that day, when he saw her at the gate, swept along like an avalanche, or like a prairie fire, or like anything that drives headlong over all obstacles.
Okay, so another idea that you might take into consideration when we discuss this, and if you want to make any comments, feel free to type them into the chat and we'll deal with them after the story, is how this concept of marriage and love is like very strong, very fortuitous. And it has more to do with a man meeting a woman, desiring the woman and having to possess the woman. So that idea of a marriage, not as a relationship on equal terms, but as a relationship of superiority of the man that selects a woman that he falls in love with, is already setting the tone in a very subversive but subtle way of what is to come. Okay, we have this idea that there is a patriarchal system, and the Aubagnys, especially because they're they're part of this upper class, as if struck by a pistol shot. Exactly. Have to have of selecting whatever they want and keeping that, taking possession of whatever they want. Love as a possessive act, not love as a sentimental relationship on equal terms. I think that's a very interesting consideration.
Monsieur Valmondé grew practical and wanted things well considered, that is, the girl's obscure origin. Armand looked into her eyes and did not care. He was reminded that she was nameless. What did it matter about a name when he could give her one of the oldest and proudest in Louisiana? He ordered the corbeille from Paris and contained himself with what patience he could until it arrived. Then they were married.
Okay, so an idea crosses his mind of Desiree not having a known past and not having a name of her own. So that distinguishes the probably the rank between the Valmondés and the Aubagnys. The Aubagnys are obviously of a higher social position than the Valmondés. And as you can see, this sweeping love makes Armand forget about any consideration about the woman's origin, because he loves her so much that cannot have any type of importance. Let's continue.
Madame Valmondé had not seen Desiree and the baby for 4 weeks. When she reached La Brie, she shuddered at the first sight of it, as she always did. It was a sad-looking place, which for many years had not known the gentle presence of a mistress. Old Monsieur Aubagny, having married and buried his wife in France, and she having loved her own land too well ever to leave it. The roof came down steep and black like a cowl, reaching out beyond the wide galleries that encircled the yellow stuccoed house. Big solemn oaks grew close to it, and their thick-leaved, far-reaching branches shadowed it like a pall. Young Aubagny's rule was a strict one, too, and under it his negroes had forgotten how to be gay, as they had been during the old master's easy-going and indulgent lifetime. The young mother was recovering slowly and lay full length in her soft white muslins and laces upon a couch. The baby was beside her, upon her arm, where he had fallen asleep at her breast. The yellow nursewoman sat beside a window fanning herself. Madame Valmondé bent her portly figure over Desiree and kissed her, holding her an instant tenderly in her arms. Then she turned to the child. "This is not the baby," she exclaimed in startled tones. French was the language spoken at Valmondé in those days. "I knew you would be astonished," laughed Desiree, "at the way he has grown. The little cochon de lait. Look at his legs, Mama, and his hands and fingernails. Real fingernails. Sandrine had to cut them this morning. Isn't it so, Sandrine?" The woman bowed her turbaned head majestically. "Merci, madame." "And the way he cries," went on Desiree, "is deafening. Armand heard him the other day as far away as La Blanche's cabin." Madame Valmondé had never removed her eyes from the child. She picked it up and walked with it over to the window that was lightest. She scanned it narrowly, then looked as searchingly at Sandrine, whose face was turned to gaze across the fields. "Yes, the child has grown, has changed," said Madame Valmondé slowly, as she replaced it beside its mother. "What does Armand say?" Desiree's face became suffused with a glow that was happiness itself. "Oh, Armand is the proudest father in the parish, I believe, chiefly because it's a boy, to bear his name, though he says not, that he would have loved a girl as well. But I know it isn't true. I know he says that to please me. And Mama," she added, drawing Madame Valmondé's head down to her and speaking in a whisper, "he hasn't punished one of them, not one of them, since baby is born. Even Negrelan, who pretended to have burnt his leg that he might rest from work. He only laughed and said Negrelan was a great scamp. Oh, Mama, I'm so happy it frightens me." What Desiree said was true. Marriage, and later the birth of his son, had softened Armand Aubigny's imperious and exacting nature greatly. This was what made the gentle Desiree so happy, for she loved him desperately. When he frowned, she trembled, but loved him. When he smiled, she asked no greater blessing of God, but Armand's dark, handsome face had not often been disfigured by frowns since the day he fell in love with her. When the baby was about 3 months old, Desiree awoke one day to the conviction that there was something in the air menacing her peace. It was at first too subtle to grasp. It had only been a disquieting suggestion, an air of mystery among the blacks, unexpected visits from far-off neighbors who could hardly account for their coming. Then a strange and awful change in her husband's manner, which she dared not ask him to explain. When he spoke to her, it was with averted eyes, from which the old love light seemed to have gone out. He absented himself from home, and when there, avoided her presence and that of her child without excuse, and the very spirit of Satan seemed suddenly to take hold of him in his dealings with the slaves. Desiree was miserable enough to die.
As you can see, I mean, she's putting forward that there's a problem, but she's not saying it in an explicit manners. She's implying ideas. Madame Valmondé seems to be more worried than rejoiced in her trip. And there is a very interesting thing that Armand has become softer towards slaves because of being a father. So he was a better slave owner, we could say. And I think that's said with a cheek and tongue. Sorry, with a tongue in cheek. My God, the opposite way, the other way around. It's really interesting how she puts forward that there something is wrong. First of all, she says it was an air of mystery among the blacks. Take into consideration the difference between the. I'm not going to spoil the end, Carlos. The difference how. It's a bit like the Mask of Red Death because it's creating a momentum, and that's absolutely true. The way of narrating is a way of creating momentum, and I like this very much in Kate Chopin because she's always very successful in creating this momentum. She builds up in a very succinct way, and it's very interesting. She gives ideas. First, she slips that there was something menacing her peace and that it was too subtle for her to grasp. First, it was like an air of mystery among the blacks. So there was like a rumor that the blacks were telling one to the other, but they weren't telling anybody else. Which is interesting, the way that the blacks are dehumanized. They don't receive a name only for a negative connotation. Only this Negrilon gets a name. Everybody else, well, Zandrine also gets a name, but there seems to be something wrong with the baby, something that Madame Valmondet can't quite place yet, but placed 3 months before Desiree did. The next parts of suspicion are when far off neighbors come just to have a look at something that's going on with the family, with her and with her baby, and the way her husband's manners change immediately. Let's continue.
She sat in her room one hot afternoon in her peignoir, listlessly drawing through her fingers the strands of her long, silky brown hair that hung about her shoulders. The baby, half naked, lay asleep upon her own great mahogany bed that was like a sumptuous throne with its satin-lined half canopy. One of La Blanche's little quadroon boys, half naked too, stood fanning the child slowly with a fan of peacock feathers. Desiree's eyes had been fixed absently and sadly upon the baby while she was striving to penetrate the threatening mist that she felt closing about her. She looked from her child to the boy who stood beside him and back again over and over. Ah! It was a cry that she could not help, which she was not conscious of having uttered. The blood turned like ice in her veins and a clammy moisture gathered upon her face.
I want you to pay attention to a bit like Rosemary's Baby. Yeah, it's similar. Pay attention to footnote 20, what a quadroon boy is. We've already read about quadroons in, I think I've talked about them when we were talking about Lauda, Quiano. They appear in Harriet Beecher Stowe's narrative. But footnote number 20 says, at the time when people of mixed descent, this miscegenation process happened, that they were classified according to the percentage of black blood. The term quadroon was a legal designation for the child of a white and a mulatto, that is, someone who had one-fourth of black blood. Under the one-drop rule, a person who looked white but had one drop of black blood could not be legally labeled white. So, as you can see, it was a very supremacist way of thinking, and the shock comes to Desiree when she looks back and forth between the quadroon boy and her baby, and she realizes something.
She tried to speak to the little quadroon boy, but no sound would come at first. When he heard his name uttered, he looked up, and his mistress was pointing to the door. He laid aside the great soft fan and obediently stole away over the polished floor on his bare tiptoes. She stayed motionless, with gaze riveted upon her child and her face the picture of fright. Presently her husband entered the room and, without noticing her, went to a table and began to search among some papers which covered it. Armand, she called to him in a voice which must have stabbed him if he was human, but he did not notice. Armand, she said again. Then she rose and tottered toward him. Armand, she panted once more, clutching his arm. Look at our child. What does it mean? Tell me. He coldly but gently loosened her fingers from about his arm and thrust the hand away from him. Tell me what it means, she cried despairingly. It means, he answered lightly, that the child is not white. It means that you are not white.
So as you can see, there's a very, very strong air of a superiority and supremacism. Armand loses all love for his wife and all love for his child the moment he comes to the realization that they are probably both not fully white people. It just goes to show how important race was in terms of social stature in that time. And take into consideration that this part of society is the most advanced socially of all the American society. So if for Creole Cajun culture, being not completely white or not legally white, was an unbearable situation for a white parent, just imagine in the rest of the society how difficult the conditions were for someone that realized that they were not white after believing that they were.
A quick connection of all that this accusation meant to her nerved her with unwanted courage to deny it. It is a lie. It is not true. I am white. Look at my hair. It is brown, and my eyes are gray. Armand, you know they are gray, and my skin is fair. Seizing his wrist, look at my hand, whiter than yours, Armand. She laughed hysterically. As white as La Blanche's, he said cruelly, and went away, leaving her alone with their child. When she could hold a pen in her hand, she sent a despairing letter to Madame Valmondé. My mother, they tell me I am not white. Armand has told me I am not white. For God's sake, tell them it is not true. You must know it is not true. I shall die. I must die. I cannot be so unhappy and live. The answer that came was as brief. My own Desiree, come home to Valmondé. Back to your mother who loves you. Come with your child. When the letter reached Desiree, she went with it to her husband's study and laid it open upon the desk before which he sat. She was like a stone image, silent, white, motionless, after she placed it there. In silence, he ran his cold eyes over the written words. He said nothing. "Shall I go, Armand?" she asked, in tones sharp with agonized suspense. "Yes, go." "Do you want me to go?" "Yes, I want you to go." He thought Almighty God had dealt cruelly and unjustly with him, and felt somehow that he was paying him back in kind when he stabbed thus into his wife's soul. Moreover, he no longer loved her because of the unconscious injury she had brought upon his home and his name. She turned away like one stunned by a blow and walked slowly towards the door, hoping he would call her back. "Goodbye, Armand," she moaned. He did not answer her. This was his last blow at fate. After it was dealt, he felt like a remorseless murderer. Desiree went in search of her child. Sandrine was pacing the somber gallery with it. She took the little one from the nurse's arms and, with no word of explanation, and descending the steps, walked away under the live oak branches. It was an October afternoon. Out in the still fields, the Negroes were picking cotton, and the sun was just sinking. Desiree had not changed the thin white garment nor the slippers which she wore. Her head was uncovered, and the sun's rays brought a golden gleam from its brown meshes. She did not take the broad beaten road which led to the far-off plantation of Valmondé. She walked across a deserted field where the stubble bruised her tender feet so delicately shod and tore her thin gown to shreds.
Take into consideration this this return to Valmondé for Desiree has two connotations. The first connotation is that she decides not to go down the beaten road. It's like the road, she seems to be no longer worthy of taking the main road. She has to go like if she were running away from something. She's seen more as a refugee or a reject than as a member of high society, as she thought she was when she married Monsieur Aubigny. And especially this deserted field where the stubble bruised her tender feet and tore her thin gown to shreds. This seems to be like a descent from paradise to hell. There is like a transformational period process there of going cross country to her mother's house as a descent from this expected paradise where she wanted to live to the reality, to the hellish reality that was going to be her life from then on. So there's a lot of metaphor in this way of going back home. because it sort of symbolizes what her life is going to be from now on, for sure.
She disappeared among the reeds and willows that grew thick along the banks of the deep, sluggish bayou, and she did not come back again. Some weeks later, there was a curious scene enacted at La Brie. In the center of the smoothly swept backyard was a great bonfire. Armand Aubigny sat in the wide hallway that commanded a view of the spectacle, and it was he who dealt out to a half-dozen Negroes the material which kept this fire ablaze. A graceful cradle of willow, with all its dainty furbishings, was laid upon the pyre, which had already been fed with the richness of a priceless layette. Then there were silk gowns and velvet and satin ones added to these two, laces too, and embroideries, bonnets and gloves, for the corbeille had been of rare quality.
So here you can see how Armand Aubigny's character has not only soured, but he wants to eliminate all existing proof of the marriage itself. He seems so ashamed of the situation that he wants to burn everything to the ground. It reminds me a bit to an attempt of cleansing his soul. This way of burning the corbel that had been so expensive to acquire and was so and was meant to turn Desiree into a sort of queen. So she is punished with having to abandon the Aubigny house, and all of her possessions are burned instead of taken to her house. It just seems that Armand's cruelty has no limits. And I think that the final twist is really a punch to the stomach, because it shows where all of this hidden guilt comes from.
The last thing to go was a tiny bundle of letters, innocent little scribblings that Desiree had sent to him during the days of their espousal. There was the remnant of one back in the drawer from which he took them, but it was not Desiree's. It was part of an old letter from his mother to his father. He read it. She was thanking God for the blessing of her husband's love. But above all, she wrote, night and day, I thank the good God for having so arranged our lives that our dear Armand will never know that his mother, who adores him, belongs to the race that is cursed with the brand of slavery. This concludes the reading of...
So as you can see, Keisha Penn is very masterful in bringing to a complete close the story in the very last line. If you read Story of an Hour, you're going to understand how the ending of stories for Keisha Penn is especially significant. And the same way that sometimes with romanticism, we don't reach closure. With realism, we normally reach full closure. And what I like especially about Keisha Penn is how she's able to wrap up the story in such a powerful way. How she completely reverses all of the assumptions that we had made about the story, and how, as a matter of fact, what we were seeing as Armand's punishment towards Desiree and towards the baby at the end was internal guilt for an attempt to hide his realization that Desiree wasn't the person that was not fully white. It was him. And as instead of fixing the situation, he decided to burn it all down. So it just goes to show how not the white people, but the white mentality was what was so flawed in that situation. It's really a very powerful ending. So I don't think in any moment you would expect to see Desiree cheating. Even though in that sense, let me tell you that there's a very good story by Keisha Penn called The Storm, that if you've discovered Kate Chopin and how fantastic she is in terms of bringing different narratives to the table. Whoops, a lamp just fell right behind my computer. Give me a second. There you go. Nothing's broken. This short story called The Storm. Let me see if I can write that there. Is that story that I told you that it took almost 100 years to be published. It was about a consensual extramarital sex. So that just shows how advanced to her time that Kate Chopin was, and why many of her stories were not only subversive, but they were direct punches to the floating line of the establishment of the time, the patriarchal society, the racial inequality. Many times Kate Chopin has been criticized by racial critics as not being aware of the injustices of racial inequality and ignoring that in her works. You know that many modern readings come to very controversial conclusions about writers of the past, and they tend to not take into consideration the period they lived in. I think that Kate Chopin probably decided that that was not her war, and she didn't fight that war. She fought the war of female liberation, and she decided to leave in a secondary place the idea of race, except for stories such as Desiree Baby, where she went she was all hands on deck, treating with the racial, racial paradox of how ridiculous the racial inequality was for the social healing of America. So yeah, I'm glad that you found the story surprising and you enjoyed it. Now let's talk about, we have like a half an hour, no, 20 minutes left to talk about Kate Chopin's work, Kate Chopin's life. First of all, she was born in this seminal year, the year where The Scarlet Letter was published. So at the height of romanticism was her birth. So obviously she's post-romantic. She's fully realist, even though I sometimes think that she includes some elements that have a far away reminiscence to some elements of romanticism. Literary movements are never, I think, absolutely pure, because they vary very much between one author and the next. She was both bilingual and bicultural. She's now considered the first major American author that was not part of this Protestant Anglo-Saxon mainstream. She was the first of this mixed French and English culture. Her parents were Irish and French. We talked about that already. She took the name of her husband, Oscar Chopin. And she went to live to New Orleans, where this territory, the Bayou, which is the Louisiana marshlands are, is almost a character in her stories. How powerful the Bayou is for the reality that she depicted in this regional color that we talked about, this regionalism. Her husband died in 1882. Her father died in a railway accident. So very soon there was a matriarchal society. I said that the same thing at the beginning of the class. There was a matriarchal structure in her house, a strongly sexist and patriarchal society of the time. So she was forced to take care of her six children. She lived with her mother, and her mother and herself were all the authority. And in a time where women were not expected to work for a living. She was a working person for the rest of her living years, for the last 3 decades of her life. As you can see, the element of her father dying in a railway accident, if you ever decide to read The Story of an Hour, you need around half an hour. You don't need more, maybe even 20 minutes. Story of an Hour, which takes place over the course of an hour. It is very connected to this idea of someone important dying in a railway accident. I'm just going to leave it there. Maybe I spur your curiosity, and after enjoying Desiree's Baby, you go off to read this other story by Kate Chopin, or maybe listen to it on LibriVox. Her literary career took off after she established this reality of living with her mom and trying to bring up her 6 children. She was unable to make a decent living only through writing, so she had to hold a day job and write at the same time. She was hungry of literary recognition and never felt fully fulfilled with her literary reputation during her lifetime. It was something that she was not successful at. The same way that, for example, we say that Walt Whitman was successful in the later part of his life, Kate Chopin was not lucky enough to be recognized for her work. Her work went on forgotten for a very long time. There has been a very strong revival in the last decades of her work. Most of her work has been, most if not all of her work has been recovered, and nowadays she has recovered and she holds a seminal position within the American literary canon, but especially she's at the pinnacle of pioneering feminist figures. She is normally categorized as a naturalist or a realist. Let me go to the glossary and read the section on naturalism. Naturalism, a late 19th century and early 20th century literary movement that encouraged the portrayal of characters caught within strong social and natural forces beyond their understanding and control. So as you can see, that tint of external forces that they cannot control reminds us slightly to Romanticism. Naturalism was founded on the belief that there is a natural rather than a supernatural explanation for everything that occurs. Naturalistic writers are concerned with the indifference of the natural universe to the plight of human beings and often emphasize the extreme vulnerability and absolute powerlessness of their characters. Next week, we're going to see a perfect example of naturalism as this subtype of realism. The same way we talk about transcendentalist and Gothic writing as being subgenres or sub-movements of the Romantic movement, we can refer to naturalism or regional color as subtypes of the realism that we were portraying with Mark Twain and with Henry James. Naturalism is just part of this realism. Naturalistic writers are concerned with the indifference of the natural universe to the plight of human beings and often emphasize extreme vulnerability and absolute powerlessness of their characters. Naturalism is sometimes categorized as a variety or a branch of realism rather than as a separate movement. As literary movements, both realism and naturalism were reactions to Romanticism. Examples of naturalistic writings in America include the works of Stephen Crane. We're going to see Stephen Crane the following week. I think that in the case of Kate Chopin, we have some naturalistic ideas. I hadn't read your comment when Desiree tells Armand, "My hands are whiter than yours." It's a hint of what's going to happen in that final twist. Of course it is. Okay, so I don't know if we ever read this the entry of realism in the glossary, but I think it's worth reminding. Realism is considered a literary movement of the late 19th century and early 20th century that sought to portray ordinary life with fidelity, avoiding idealization and any rendering of fantastic or improbable events. Realist writers often made their readers aware of the fact that reality is perceived from different partial perspectives. As a literary movement, realism opposed romanticism. Apart from specifically denoting a literary movement, the term realism also refers to a particular method of composition. Okay, so after seeing the slight difference between realism and naturalism, where nature has this overwhelming effect on versus the insignificance of men, I don't know if it can be deemed as a complete opposition to romanticism, especially to transcendentalism. I think that at the end of the day, naturalism just takes it a bit further. But this is a topic that exceeds what is the focus that we want to have in this class. We want to be able to categorize Kate Chopin as both naturalist and realist, depending on the work. We're also going to say the same about our last author, Stephen Crane. Things that come up in Kate Chopin, recurring themes in her works: love, marriage, sex, but not the 19th century sex, good sex, let's say. It's mostly a liberating view on sex, which is absolutely outrageous at the time. Of course it is. Elitist Creole culture, Cajun culture, the French South, Louisiana, personal liberation, race, and class. So you can see that all of her ideas, or most of her ideas, are absolutely outrageous for her time, and for sure made her work highly criticized. When we refer to Creole culture, we're referring to the European and partially Black Caribbean descended population that still lived in America. When we talk about the Cajun culture, we talk about the Frenchicized or French culture that was coexisting in Louisiana with the rest of the society. So both Creole and Cajun have a succinct Frenchness to themselves. Maybe Cajun is more local, and Creole is more of the people, of people that emigrated from France to the United States, and also the descendants of the Black and mulatto people from the French colonies of the Caribbean territories that went to live to America. So as you can see, there are a lot of different origins of the people that live in Louisiana. It's not only the locals, and that type of society is going to be a society within the mainstream American society, and that's what Kate Chopin tries to illustrate in her works. Normally, a more advanced socially, or more open to different ways of living, different ways of thinking, but at the same time also with very strong social constraints and red lines, the same as the traditional white class also had. She uses this local color framework as a way of subverting genre topics and dismantling conservative ideas. This is why the works of Kate Chopin always have this subversive touch. You always feel that she sets off to tell you a standard story, an entertaining story, but she has a hidden agenda. Desiree as Disarray, that would be a fantastic concept to connect those two ideas of the Desiree as having the double meaning of the desired and at the end, and also as a disarray of race, no, race and class. She went beyond this local atmosphere because for her, the local color was just a way of going undercover and talking about what she wanted to talk about. The genre and the patriarchal constraints of society. She wanted to explore and to criticize the values of Southern society. That's why her work follows a pattern of this Southern style narrative, but at the end of the day was subversive to the expected outcome of these contented slaves and their very kind slave owners that we sometimes read in the narratives of the time. She seemed to hold no nostalgia for the past and did not represent the South with harmonious gender and race relationships, but all the opposite, a pent-up problem of gender struggle and race inequality. Okay, so women were happy if they were able to live within the constraints of a patriarchal system. Slaves were denied the possibility of having a future, having a life of their own, and they could only reach a moderate amount of happiness under the chains of slavery, which was, of course, not a complete way of being happy. Before we adjourn the class, let me talk quickly about The Awakening because of its importance to understand Kate Chopin. It's basically her most famous work and where her current reputation lies upon nowadays. It is considered a literary masterpiece. It's very well written, and it can be there are so many symbols in the story that every time you read it, you keep uncovering symbols. I read it practically every year because I have to have it fresh to be able to talk about it in class for a few weeks, and that makes it a very interesting exercise of unraveling symbols that I totally read past in previous occasions, and I think it's a work that's very readable and rereadable and very interesting. The original title of The Awakening is A Solitary Soul, and it's a sort of American Madame Bovary. It's an interesting and complex narrative, and we already heard Achille talking about how he enjoyed the narrative, but at the same time, you feel for the main character, Edna Pontellier, who is a discontented wife and woman. It is one of the first works of fiction that deals with women as a main protagonist role without any amount of condescension. I think it's Kate Chopin's most self-biographical story. She is obviously Edna Pontellier, and the awakening of Edna is the awakening that Kate Chopin had wished for herself, her awakening to life, her awakening to sexual freedom and artistic fulfillment, this idea of the woman being able to break away from the patriarchal society. There were many hostile reactions to Chopin's sympathetic treatment of her female protagonist, and she was slammed for her work, especially about the way she handled themes like motherhood, sexual promiscuity, well, adultery, as it is called there, and the idea of I don't want to spoil the whole thing, so I'm going to refrain from what I was just about to say. The idea that happiness was achieved through marrying into the right family with a loving husband that at the end of the day objectified the women and treated women as just another possession that they had lying around their house, such as a couch or expensive silverware. At the end of the day, it's a full attack on the concept of 19th century marriage and the role for women in that society. Her publishers canceled the publication of her third collection of stories, and she had to rehash those stories one by one through magazines, it was problematic for some stories, and that's why The Storm wasn't published until much later, because they dealt with sex, love, and marriage in many cases. I think we have a full picture of Keisha Penn. I want to thank you for your great attendance today, seven people. I'm very happy that you're hanging in there with me. Yes, for sure. Through these last classes, remember that next week we have Stephen Crane, and the last week we're going to review all of the authors and maybe think about some exam questions as we did in the first semester. We'll devote our last class to that. And if you have any questions about Keisha Penn or about any of the other authors, please let me know. Send a message in the forum. Thanks a lot. Have a good week. Thank you very much, Carlos. Bye, Constance.